Hydraulics technology ultimately did progress to the point where it could address the needs of mainstream excavation contractors. That progress was achieved, however, by the entrant companies, who had first found a market for the initial capabilities of the technology, accumulated design and manufacturing experience in that market, and then used that commercial platform to attack the value networks above them. The established firms lost this contest. Only four cable excavator companies, Inslee, Caring, Little Giant, and Link Belt, remained as viable suppliers to excavation contractors by successfully, but belatedly, introducing lines of hydraulic excavators to defend their markets. Aside from these, however, the other leading manufacturers of big cable machines in the mainstream excavation markets never introduced a commercially successful hydraulic excavator. Although some had employed hydraulics to a modest degree as a bucket curling mechanism, they lacked the design expertise and volume-based manufacturing cost position to compete as hydraulics invaded the mainstream. By the early 1970s, all of these firms had been driven from the sewer, piping, and general excavation markets by the entrants, most of which had refined their technological capabilities initially in the small contractor market. This contrast in strategies for profiting from change characterizes the approaches employed by entrant and established firms in many of the other industries affected by disruptive technologies, particularly disk drives, steel, computers, and electric cars. The choice between cable and hydraulics. When hydraulics technology became capable of addressing the bucket-sized needs of sewer and piping contractors, and a similar trajectory could be sketched for arm reach, the competitive dynamics in the industry changed, and the mainstream excavation contractors changed the criteria by which they purchased their equipment. Even today, the cable-actuated architecture can attain much longer reach and greater lift than can hydraulic excavators. They have roughly parallel technology trajectories. But once both cable and hydraulics-actuated systems could satisfy mainstream market requirements, excavation contractors could no longer base their choice of equipment on which had longer reach and greater bucket capacity. Both were good enough, and the fact that cable was better ceased to have competitive relevance. Contractors found, however, that hydraulic machines were much less prone to breakdowns than cable-actuated excavators. In particular, those who had experienced the life-threatening snap of a cable while hefting a heavy bucket embraced reliable hydraulics quickly, as soon as it was capable of doing the job. Once both technologies were good enough in the basic capabilities demanded, therefore, the basis of product choice in the market shifted to reliability. Sewer and piping contractors began adopting hydraulic equipment rapidly beginning in the early 1960s, and general excavation contractors followed later in the decade. Consequences and implications of the hydraulics eruption. What went wrong within the companies that made cable-actuated excavators? Clearly, with the benefit of hindsight, they should have invested in hydraulics machines and embedded that piece of their organizations charged with making hydraulic products in the value network that needed them. But the dilemma in managing the disruptive technology in the heat of the battle is that nothing went wrong inside these companies. Hydraulics was a technology that their customers didn't need. Indeed, couldn't use. Each cable shovel manufacturer was one of at least 20 manufacturers doing everything they could to steal each other's customers. If they took their eyes off their customers' next generation needs, existing business would have been put at risk. Moreover, developing bigger, better, and faster cable excavators to steal share from existing competitors constituted a much more obvious opportunity for profitable growth than did a venture into hydraulic backhoes, given how small the backhoe market was when it appeared in the 1950s. So, as we have seen before, these companies did not fail because the technology wasn't available. They did not fail because they lacked information about hydraulics or how to use it. Indeed, the best of them used it as soon as it could help their customers. They did not fail because management was sleepy or arrogant. They failed because hydraulics didn't make sense until it was too late. The patterns of success and failure we see among firms faced with sustaining and disruptive technology change are a natural or a systematic result of good managerial decisions. That is, in fact, why disruptive technologies confront innovators with such a dilemma. Working harder, being smarter, investing more aggressively, and listening more astutely to customers are all solutions to the problems posed by new sustaining technologies. But these paradigms of sound management are useless, even counterproductive in many instances, when dealing with disruptive technology. Chapter 4. What goes up can't go down. It is clear from the histories of the disk drive and excavator industries that the boundaries of value networks do not completely imprison the companies within them. There is considerable upward mobility into other networks. It is in restraining downward mobility into the markets enabled by disruptive technologies that the value networks exercise such unusual power. In this chapter, we will explore these questions. Why could leading companies migrate so readily toward high-end markets, and why does moving down market appear to have been so difficult? Rational managers, as we shall see, can rarely build a cogent case for entering small, poorly defined low-end markets that offer only lower profitability. In fact, the prospects for growth and improved profitability in upmarket value networks often appear to be so much more attractive than the prospect of staying within the current value network that it is not unusual to see well-managed companies leaving or becoming uncompetitive with their original customers as they search for customers at higher price points. In good companies, resources and energy coalesce most readily behind proposals to attack upmarket into higher performance products that can earn higher margins. Indeed, the prospects for improving financial performance by moving toward upmarket value networks are so strong that one senses a huge magnet in the northeast corner of the disk drive and excavator trajectory maps. This chapter examines the power of this northeastern pull by looking at evidence from the history of the disk drive industry. It then generalizes this framework by exploring the same phenomenon in the battle between mini-mill and integrated steelmakers. The Great Northeast Migration in Disk Drives. One table plots in more detail the upmarket movement of Seagate Technology, whose strategy was typical of most disk drive manufacturers. Recall that Seagate had spawned and then grew to dominate the value network for desktop computing. Its product position relative to capacity demanded in its market is mapped by vertical lines, which span from the lowest to the highest capacity drives in its product line, in each of the years shown. The black rectangle on the line measuring each year's capacity span shows the median capacity of the drives Seagate introduced in each of those years. Between 1983 and 1985, the center of gravity of Seagate's product line was positioned squarely on the average capacity demanded in the desktop segment. It was between 1987 and 1989 that the disruptive 3.5-inch form invaded the desktop market from below. Seagate responded to that attack, not by fighting the disruptive technology head-on, but by retreating upmarket. It continued to offer models in the capacity ranges the desktop PC market demanded. But by 1993, the focus of its energy had clearly shifted to the market for mid-range computers, such as file servers, and engineering workstations. Indeed, disruptive technologies have such a devastating impact because the firms that first commercialized each generation of disruptive disk drives chose not to remain contained within their initial value network. Rather, they reached as far upmarket as they could in each new product generation until their drives packed the capacity to appeal to the value networks above them. It is this upward mobility that makes disruptive technologies so dangerous to established firms and so attractive to entrants. Value networks and characteristic cost structures. What lies behind this asymmetric mobility As we have already seen, it is driven by resource allocation processes that direct resources toward new product proposals that promise higher margins and larger markets. These are almost always better in the northeast portions of trajectory maps than in the southeast. The disk drive manufacturers migrated to the northeast corner of the product market map because the resource allocation processes they employed took them there. As we heard in Chapter 2, a characteristic of each value network is a particular cost structure that firms within it must create if they are to provide the products and services in the priority their customers demand. Thus, as the disk drive makers became large and successful within their home value network, they developed a very specific economic character, tuning their levels of effort and expenses in research, development, sales, marketing, and administration to the needs of their customers and the challenges of their competitors. Gross margins tended to evolve in each value network to levels that enabled the better disk drive makers to make money, given these costs of doing business. In turn, this gave these companies a very specific model for improving profitability. Generally, they found it difficult to improve profitability by hacking out cost while steadfastly standing in their mainstream market. The research, development, marketing, and administrative costs they were incurring were all critical to remaining competitive in their mainstream business. Moving upmarket toward higher performance products that promised higher gross margins was usually a more straightforward path to profit improvement. Moving downmarket was anathema to that objective. The obviousness of the path toward profit improvement is shown in another table. The three bars on the left depict the size of the desktop, mini-computer, and mainframe computer value networks in 1981, and are labeled with the characteristic margins enjoyed by disk drive makers in each of those networks. Gross margins are clearly higher in higher-ended markets, compensating manufacturers for the higher levels of overhead characteristic of those businesses. The differences in the size of these markets and the characteristic cost structures across these value networks created serious asymmetries in the combat among these firms. Firms making 8-inch drives for the mini computer market, for example, had cost structures requiring gross margins of 40%. Aggressively moving down market would have pitted them against foes who had honed their cost structures to make money at 25% gross margins. On the other hand, moving upmarket enabled them to take a relatively lower cost structure into a market that was accustomed to giving its suppliers 60% gross margins. Which direction made sense? A similar asymmetry faced the makers of 5.25-inch drives in 1986, as they decided whether to spend their resources building a position in the emerging market for 3.5-inch drives in portable computers or to move up toward the mini-computer and mainframe companies. Committing development resources to launch higher-performance products that could garner higher gross margins generally both offered greater returns and caused less pain. As their managers were making repeated decisions about which new product development proposals they should fund and which they should shelve, proposals to develop higher-performance products targeted at the larger, higher-margin markets immediately above them always got the resources. In other words, sensible resource allocation processes were at the root of companies' upward mobility and downmarket immobility across the boundaries of the value networks in the disk drive industry. The hedonic regression analysis, summarized in Chapter 2, showed that higher-end markets consistently paid significantly higher prices for incremental megabytes of capacity. Why would anyone opt to sell a megabyte for less when it could be sold for more? The disk drive company's migration to the Northeast was, as such, highly rational. Other scholars have found evidence in other industries that as companies leave their disruptive roots in search of greater profitability in the market tiers above them, they gradually come to acquire the cost structures required to compete in those upper market tiers. This exacerbates their problem of downward immobility. Resource allocation and upward migration. Further insight into this asymmetric mobility across value networks comes from comparing two different descriptive models of how resources are allocated. The first model describes resource allocation as a rational, top-down decision-making process in which senior managers weigh alternative proposals for investment in innovation and put money into those projects that they find to be consistent with firm strategy and to offer the highest return on investment. Proposals that don't clear these hurdles are killed. The second model of resource allocation, first articulated by Joseph Bauer, characterizes resource allocation decisions much differently. Bauer notes that most proposals to innovate are generated from deep within the organization, not from the top. As these ideas bubble up from the bottom, the organization's middle managers play a critical but invisible role in screening these projects. These managers can't package and throw their weight behind every idea that passes by. They need to decide which are the best, which are most likely to succeed, and which are most likely to be approved, given the corporate financial, competitive, and strategic climate. In most organizations, managers' careers receive a big boost when they play a key sponsorship role in very successful projects, and their careers can be permanently derailed if they have the bad judgment or misfortune to back projects that fail. Middle managers aren't penalized for all failures, of course. Projects that fail because the technologists couldn't deliver, for example, often are not necessarily regarded as failures at all, because a lot is learned from the effort, and because technology development is generally regarded as an unpredictable, probabilistic endeavor. But projects that fail because the market wasn't there have far more serious implications for managers' careers. These tend to be much more expensive and public failures. They generally occur after the company has made full investments in product design, manufacturing, engineering, marketing, and distribution. Hence, middle managers, acting in both their own and the company's interest, tend to back those projects for which market demand seems most assured. They then work to package the proposals for their chosen projects in ways geared to win senior management approval. As such, while senior managers may think they're making the resource allocation decisions, many of the really critical resource allocation decisions have actually been made long before senior management gets involved. Middle managers have made their decisions about which projects they'll back and carry to senior management, and which they will allow to languish. Consider the implications of this for a successful firm's downward and upward mobility from its initial value network in this hypothetical example. In the same week, two respected employees, one from marketing, the other from engineering, run two very different ideas for new products past their common manager, two levels above them in the organization. The marketer comes first, with an idea for a higher capacity, higher speed model. The two levels up manager starts her interrogation. Who's going to buy it? Well, there's a whole segment in the workstation industry. They buy over $600 million in drives each year that we've just never been able to reach because our capacity points just don't reach that high. I think this product just might get us there. Have you run this idea past any potential customers? Yeah, I was in California last week. They all said they wanted prototypes as soon as they could get them. There's a design window opening up in 9 months. They've been working with their current supplier, Competitor X, to get something ready, but someone we just hired from Competitor X said they're having lots of trouble meeting the specs. I really think we can do it. But does engineering think we can do it? They say it'll be a stretch, but you know them. They always say that. What kind of margins are we looking at up there? That's what really excites me about this. If we can build it in our current factory, given the price per megabyte Competitor X has been getting, I think we can get close to 35%. Compare that conversation to the manager's interchange with the engineer, whose idea is for a cheaper, smaller, slower, lower capacity disruptive disk drive. Who's going to buy it? Well, I'm not sure, but there's got to be a market out there somewhere for it. People are always wanting things smaller and less expensive. I could see them using it in fax machines, printers maybe. Have you run this idea past any potential customers? Yeah. When I was at the last trade show, I sketched the idea out for one of our current customers. He said he was interested, but couldn't see how they could really use it. Today, you really need 270 megabytes to run everything, and there's just no way we could get that kind of capacity on this thing, at least not for a while. His response doesn't surprise me, really. How about the guys who make fax machines? What do they think? Well, they say they don't know. Again, it's an intriguing idea, but they already have their product plans pretty well set, and none of them use disk drives. You think we could make money on this project? Well, I think so. But that depends on how we could price it, of course. Which of the two projects will the two levels up manager back? In the tug of war for development resources, projects targeted at the explicit needs of current customers or at the needs of existing users that a supplier has not yet been able to reach will always win over proposals to develop products for markets that do not exist. This is because, in fact, the best resource allocation systems are designed precisely to weed out ideas that are unlikely to find large, profitable, receptive markets. Any company that doesn't have a systematic way of targeting its development resources toward customers' needs, in fact, will fail. The most vexing managerial aspect of this problem of asymmetry, where the easiest path to growth and profit is up, and the most deadly attacks come from below, is that good management, working harder and smarter and being more visionary, doesn't solve the problem. The resource allocation process involves thousands of decisions, some subtle and some explicit, made every day by hundreds of people, about how their time and the company's money ought to be spent. Even when a senior manager decides to pursue a disruptive technology, the people in the organization are likely to ignore it or, at best, cooperate reluctantly if it doesn't fit their model of what it takes to succeed as an organization and as individuals within an organization. Well-run companies are not populated by yes people who have been taught to carry out mindlessly the directives of management. Rather, their employees have been trained to understand what is good for the company and what it takes to build a successful career within the company. Employees of great companies exercise initiative to serve customers and meet budgeted sales and profits. It is very difficult for a manager to motivate competent people to energetically and persistently pursue a course of action that they think makes no sense. An example from the history of the disk drive industry illustrates the impact of such employee behavior. The case of the 1.8-inch disk drive. Managers in disk drive companies were very generous in helping me conduct the research reported in this book, and as the results began emerging in 1992, I began feeding back the published papers that summarized what I was learning. I was particularly interested in whether the framework summarized earlier would have an impact on their decisions regarding the 1.8-inch drive, which was just then emerging as the industry's most recent disruptive technology. For industry outsiders, of course, the conclusion was obvious. How many times does this have to happen before these guys learn? Of course they've got to do it. The guys did, in fact, learn. By the end of 1993, each of the leading drive makers had developed 1.8-inch models and had them ready for introduction if and when the market developed. In August 1994, I was visiting the CEO of one of the largest disk drive companies and asked him what his firm was doing about the 1.8-inch drive. This clearly touched a hot button. He pointed to a shelf in his office where a sample 1.8-inch drive was perched. "You see that?" he demanded. "That's the fourth generation of 1.8-inch drives we've developed, each one with more capacity than the last. But we haven't sold any. We want to be ready when the market is there, but there just isn't a market for them yet." I countered by reminding him that Disk Trend Report, a highly regarded market research publication that was the source of much of the data used in my study, had measured the 1993 market at $40 million, was projecting 1994 sales to be $80 million, and forecast 1995 volume at $140 million. "I know that's what they think," he responded, but they're wrong. There isn't a market. We've had that drive in our catalog for 18 months. Everyone knows we've got it, but nobody wants it. The market just isn't there. We just got way ahead of the market. I had no other basis for pressing my point with this manager, who is one of the most astute managers I've ever met. Our conversation moved to other issues. About a month later, I was leading a case discussion in the Harvard MBA program's Technology and Operations Management course about the development of a new engine at Honda. One of the students in the class had previously worked in Honda's research and development organization, so I asked him to take a few minutes to tell the class what it was like working there. It turned out that he had been working on dashboard mapping and navigation systems. I couldn't resist interrupting his talk by asking, "How do you store all that data for the maps?" Said the student, "We found a little 1.8-inch disk drive and put it in there. It's really neat. Almost a solid-state device with very few moving parts. Really rugged." "Who do you buy them from?" I pressed. "It's kind of funny," he replied. "You can't buy them from any of the big disk drive companies. We get them from a little startup company somewhere in Colorado. I can't remember the name." I have since reflected on why the head of this company would insist so stubbornly that there was no market for 1.8-inch drives, even while there was, and why my student would say the big drive makers didn't sell these drives, even though they were trying. The answer lies in the northeast-southeast problem, and in the role that the hundreds of well-trained decision-makers in a good company play in funneling resources and energy into those projects they perceive will bring the company the greatest growth and profit. The CEO had decided that the company was going to catch this next disruptive wave early and had shepherded the project through to a successful economical design. But among the employees, there was nothing about an $80 million low-end market that solved the growth and profit problems of a multi-billion dollar company, especially when capable competitors were doing all they could to steal away the customers providing those billions. The revenue figure is disguised. And way at the other end of the company, there was nothing about supplying prototype quantities of 1.8-inch drives to an automaker that solved the problem of meeting the 1994 quotas of salespeople whose contacts and expertise were based so solidly in the computer industry. For an organization to accomplish a task as complex as launching a new product, logic, energy, and impetus must all coalesce behind the effort. Hence, it is not just the customers of an established firm that hold it captive to their needs. Established firms are also captive to the financial structure and organizational culture inherent in the value network in which they compete, a captivity that can block any rationale for timely investment in the next wave of disruptive technology. Value networks and market visibility. The impetus to drift up market can be particularly powerful when a firm's customers themselves are migrating up market. In such circumstances, suppliers of an intermediate component such as a disk drive may not sense their northeasterly migration because they are embedded among competitors and customers experiencing a similar drift. In this light, we can see how easy it would have been for the leading 8-inch disk drive makers, Priam, Quantum, and Shugart, to miss the 5.25-inch generation of drives. Not a single one of their core customers, for example, Digital Equipment, Prime Computer, Data General, Wang Laboratories, and Nixdorf, successfully introduced a desktop computer. Instead, each was moving upmarket itself toward ever higher performance segments of their markets, trying to win the business of customers who historically had used mainframes. Similarly, not a single one of the customers of the 14-inch drive makers, mainframe makers, such as Univac, Burroughs, NCR, ICL, Siemens, and Amdahl, ever made a bold enough move down market into mini-computers to become a significant player there. Three factors: the promise of upmarket margins, the simultaneous upmarket movement of many of a company's customers, and the difficulty of cutting costs to move down market profitability, together create powerful barriers to downward mobility. In the internal debates about resource allocation for new product development, therefore, proposals to pursue disruptive technologies generally lose out to proposals to move upmarket. In fact, cultivating a systematic approach to weeding out new product development initiatives that would likely lower profits is one of the most important achievements of any well-managed company. An important strategic implication of this rational pattern of upmarket movement is that it can create vacuum in low-end value networks that draws in entrants with technologies and cost structures better suited to competition. One of these powerful downmarket voids occurred in the steel industry, for example, when entrant companies employing disruptive mini-mill process technology entered through low-end beachheads. They have attacked relentlessly upmarket ever since. The northeasterly migration of integrated steel. Mini-mill steelmaking first became commercially viable in the mid-1960s. Employing widely available and familiar technology and equipment, mini-mills melt scrap steel in electric arc furnaces, continuously cast it into intermediate shapes called billets, and then roll those into products such as bars, rods, beams, or sheets. They are called mini-mills because the scale at which they produce cost-competitive molten steel from scrap is less than one-tenth of the scale required for an integrated mill to produce cost-competitive molten steel from iron ore in blast and basic oxygen furnaces. Integrated mills take their name from the integrated process of transforming iron, ore, coal, and limestone into final steel shapes. Integrated mills and mini-mills look much the same in their processes of continuous casting and rolling operations. Scale is the only difference. The output of efficiently sized blast furnaces requires that integrated mills' casting and rolling operations must be much greater than those of the mini-mills. North America's steel mini-mills are the most efficient, lowest-cost steelmakers in the world. In 1995, the most efficient mini-mill required 0.6 labor hours per ton of steel produced. The best integrated mill required 2.3 labor hours. In the product categories in which they compete, the average mini-mill can make product of equivalent quality on a fully costed basis at about a 15% lower cost than the average integrated mill. In 1995, it cost about $400 million to build a cost-competitive steel mini-mill and about $6 billion to build a cost-competitive integrated mill. In terms of capital cost per ton of steel-making capacity, integrated mills are more than four times as costly to build. As a result, mini-mills' share of the North American market has grown from nothing in 1965 to 19% in 1975, 32% in 1985, and 40% in 1995. Experts predict they will account for half of all steel production by the turn of the century. Mini-mills virtually dominate the North American markets for rods, bars, and structural beams. Yet not a single one of the world's major integrated steel companies to date has built a mill employing mini-mill technology. Why would none of them do something that makes so much sense? The explanation forwarded most frequently by the business press, especially in the United States, is that the managers of the integrated companies are conservative, backward-looking, risk-averse, and incompetent. Consider these indictments. Last year, U.S. Steel Corp. closed 15 of its facilities, claiming they had become non-competitive. 3 years ago, Bethlehem Steel Corp. shuttered major portions of its plants in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and Lackawanna, New York. The closing of these major steel complexes is the final dramatic concession from today's chief executives that management has not been doing its job. It represents decades of maximizing profits to look good for the short term. If the U.S. steel industry were as productive in tons per man hour as it is in rhetoric per problem, it would be a top-notch performer. Surely there is some credibility to such accusations, but managerial incompetence cannot be a complete answer for the failure of North American integrated mills to counter the conquest by mini-mills of vast portions of the steel industry. none of what most experts regard as the best managed and most successful of the world's integrated steelmakers, including Nippon, Kawasaki, and NKK in Japan, British Steel and Hugovens in Europe, and Pohang Steel in Korea, has invested in mini-mill technology, even though it is demonstrably the lowest-cost technology in the world. At the same time, in the last decade, the management teams at integrated mills have taken aggressive steps to increase mill efficiency. USX, for example, improved the efficiency of its steelmaking operations from more than 9 labor hours per ton of steel produced in 1980 to just under 3 hours per ton in 1991. It accomplished this by ferociously attacking the size of its workforce, paring it from more than 93,000 in 1980 to fewer than 23,000 in 1991, and by investing more than $2 billion in modernizing its plant and equipment. Yet all of this managerial aggressiveness was targeted at conventional ways of making steel. How can this be? Mini-mill steelmaking is a disruptive technology. When it emerged in the 1960s, because it used scrap steel, it produced steel of marginal quality. The properties of its products varied according to the metallurgical composition and impurities of the scrap. Hence, about the only market that mini-mill producers could address was that for steel reinforcing bars, rebars, right at the bottom of the market in terms of quality, cost, and margins. This market was the least attractive of those served by established steelmakers. And not only were margins low, but customers were the least loyal. They would switch suppliers at will, dealing with whoever offered the lowest price. The integrated steelmakers were almost relieved to be rid of the rebar business. The mini-mills, however, saw the rebar market quite differently. They had very different cost structures than those of the integrated mills. Little depreciation, and no research and development costs. Low sales expenses, mostly telephone bills, and minimal general managerial overhead. They could sell by telephone virtually all the steel they could make, and sell it profitably. Once they had established themselves in the rebar market, the most aggressive mini-mills, especially Nucor and Chaparral, developed a very different view of the overall steel market than the view that the integrated mills held. Whereas the downmarket rebar territory they seized had looked singularly unattractive to their integrated competitors, the mini-mills' view upmarket showed that opportunities for greater profits and expanded sales were all above them. With such incentive, they worked to improve the metallurgical quality and consistency of their products and invested in equipment to make larger shapes. A trajectory map indicates that the mini-mills next attacked the markets for larger bars, rods, and angle irons immediately above them. By 1980, they had captured 90% of the rebar market and held about 30% of the markets for bars, rods, and angle irons. At the time of the mini-mills attack, the bar, rod, and angle iron shapes brought the lowest margins in the integrated mills' product lines. As a consequence, the integrated steelmakers were again almost relieved to be rid of the business. And by the mid-1980s, this market belonged to the mini-mills. Once their position in the market for bars, rods, and angle irons seemed secure, the mini-mills continued their march upmarket, this time toward structural beams. Nucor did so from a new mini-mill plant in Arkansas, and Chaparral launched its attack from a new mill adjacent to its first one in Texas. The integrated mills were driven from this market by the mini-mills as well. In 1992, USX closed its South Chicago structural steel mill, leaving Bethlehem as the only integrated North American structural steel maker. Bethlehem closed its last structural beam plant in 1995, leaving the field to the mini-mills. An important part of this story is that throughout the 1980s, as they were ceding the bar and beam business to the mini-mills, the integrated steelmakers experienced dramatically improving profit. Not only were these firms attacking cost, they were forsaking their lowest margin products and focusing increasingly on high-quality rolled sheet steel, where quality-sensitive manufacturers of cans, cars, and appliances paid premium prices for metallurgically consistent steel with defect-free surfaces. Indeed, the lion's share of integrated mills' investments in the 1980s had been targeted at improving their ability to provide the most demanding customers in these three markets with the highest quality product, and to do so profitably. Sheet steel markets were an attractive haven for the integrated producers, in part because they were protected from mini-mill competition. It cost about $2 billion to build a state-of-the-art, cost-competitive sheet steel rolling mill, and this capital outlay simply had been too much for even the largest of the mini-mills. Targeting the premium end of the market pleased the integrated mills' investors. For example, Bethlehem Steel's market value had leapt from $175 million in 1986 to $2.4 billion in 1989. This represented a very attractive return on the $1.3 billion the company invested in R&D and plant and equipment during this period. The business press generously acknowledged these aggressive, well-placed investments. Walter Williams, Bethlehem's CEO, has worked wonders. Over the past 3 years, he mounted a highly personal campaign to improve the quality and productivity of Bethlehem's basic steel business. Bethlehem's metamorphosis has outclassed even its major U.S. competitors, which as a whole are now producing at lower costs than their Japanese rivals and are fast closing the quality gap. Customers notice the difference. "It's nothing short of miraculous," says a top purchaser of sheet steel at Campbell Soup. Another analyst made similar observations. While almost no one was looking, a near miracle occurred. Big Steel is making a quiet comeback. Gary Works, U.S. Steel, is back in the black, pouring out a glowing river of molten iron at the rate of 3 million tons per year, a North American record. Union management problem-solving teams are everywhere. Instead of making steel in all shapes and sizes, Gary has focused almost entirely on higher-value flat-rolled steel. Almost all of us would agree that these remarkable recoveries were the fruits of good management. But where will good management in this genre lead these firms? Mini-mill thin slab casting for sheet steel. While integrated steelmakers were busy engineering their recoveries, more disruptive clouds began gathering on the horizon. In 1987, a German supplier of equipment for the steel industry, Schlumann Zimag AG, announced that it had developed what it called continuous thin slab casting technology, a way for steel to be continuously cast from its molten state into long, thin slabs that could be transported directly, without cooling, into a rolling mill. Rolling the white-hot, already thin slab of steel to the final thickness of coiled sheet steel was much simpler than the traditional task mastered by the integrated mills of reheating and rolling sheet from thick ingots or slabs. Most important, a cost-competitive continuous thin slab casting and rolling mill could be built for less than $250 million. One-tenth the capital cost of a traditional sheet mill, and a relatively manageable investment for a mini-mill steel maker. At this scale, an electric arc furnace could easily supply the required quantity of molten steel. Moreover, thin slab casting promised at least a 20% reduction in the total cost of making sheet steel. Because of its promise, thin slab casting was carefully evaluated by every major player in the steel industry. Some integrated mills, such as USX, worked very hard to justify installation of a thin slab facility. In the end, however, it was mini-mill Nucor Steel, rather than the integrated mills, that made the bold move into thin slab casting. Why? At the outset, thin slab casting technology could not offer the smooth, defect-free surface finish required by the integrated mills' mainstream customers, makers of cans, cars, and appliances. The only markets were those such as construction decking and corrugated steel for culverts, pipes, and Quonset huts, in which users were more sensitive to price than to surface blemishes. thin slab casting was a disruptive technology. Furthermore, large, capable, and hungry integrated competitors were busy trying to rob each other's most profitable business with the large auto, appliance, and can companies. It made no sense for them to target capital investment at thin slab casting, positioned as it was in the least profitable, most price competitive, and commodity-like end of their business. Indeed, after seriously considering between 1987 and 1988 whether to invest in thin slab casting at an amount then projected to be about $150 million, both Bethlehem and USX elected instead to invest in conventional thick slab continuous casters at a cost of $250 million to protect and enhance the profitability of the business with their mainstream customers. Not surprisingly, Nucor saw the situation another way. Unencumbered by the demands of profitable customers in the sheet steel business and benefiting from a cost structure forged at the bottom of the industry, Nucor fired up the world's first continuous thin slab casting facility in Crawfordsville, Indiana, in 1989, and constructed a second mill in Hickman, Arkansas, in 1992. It increased its capacity at both sites by 80% in 1995. Analysts estimate that Nucor had captured 7% of the massive North American sheet market by 1996. Hardly enough to concern the integrated mills, because Nucor's success has been limited to the commoditized, least profitable end of their product line. Of course, in its effort to win higher margin business with higher quality products from these mills, Nucor has already improved the surface quality of its sheet steel substantially. Thus, the integrated steel company's march to the profitable northeast corner of the steel industry is a story of aggressive investment, rational decision-making, close attention to the needs of mainstream customers, and record profits. It is the same innovator's dilemma that confounded the leading providers of disk drives and mechanical excavators. Sound managerial decisions are at the very root of their impending fall from industry leadership. Part 2. Managing Disruptive Technological Change. In the search for reasons why so many strong companies in three very different industries stumbled or failed, the research summarized in the preceding chapters cast doubt on several conventional explanations other researchers have offered. It wasn't the case that the leading company's engineers tended to get stuck in a particular technological paradigm or ignored innovations that were not invented here. The cause of failure could not be solely attributed to established firms' inadequate competence in new technological fields or their inability to stay atop their industry's technological mudslide. Of course, these problems do afflict some companies, but as a general rule, the evidence is very strong that as long as the new technology was required to address the needs of their customers, established firms were able to muster the expertise, capital, suppliers, energy, and rationale to develop and implement the requisite technology both competitively and effectively. This has been true for incremental as well as radical advances, for projects that consumed months as well as those lasting more than a decade, in fast-paced disk drives, in the slower-paced mechanical excavator industry, and in the process-intensive steel industry. Probably the most important outcome of this attempt to define the problem is that it ruled out poor management as a root cause. Again, this is not to say that good and bad management aren't key factors affecting the fortunes of firms. But as a general explanation, the managers of the companies studied here had a great track record in understanding customers' future needs, identifying which technologies could best address those needs, and in investing to develop and implement them. It was only when confronted with disruptive technology that they failed. There had, therefore, to be a reason why good managers consistently made wrong decisions when faced with disruptive technological change. The reason is that good management itself was the root cause. Managers played the game the way it was supposed to be played. The very decision-making and resource allocation processes that are key to the success of established companies are the very processes that reject disruptive technologies, listening carefully to customers, tracking competitors' actions carefully, and investing resources to design and build higher performance, higher quality products that will yield greater profit. These are the reasons why great firms stumbled or failed when confronted with disruptive technological change. Successful companies want their resources to be focused on activities that address customers' needs, that promise higher profits, that are technologically feasible, and that help them play in substantial markets. Yet, to expect the processes that accomplish these things also to do something like nurturing disruptive technologies, to focus resources on proposals that customers reject, that offer lower profit, that underperform existing technologies, and can only be sold in insignificant markets, is akin to flapping one's arms with wings strapped to them in an attempt to fly. Such expectations involve fighting some fundamental tendencies about the way successful organizations work and about how their performance is evaluated. Part two of this book is built upon detailed case studies of a few companies that succeeded, and many more that failed, when faced with disruptive technological change. Just as in our analogy to man's finally learning to fly, when aviators ultimately came to understand and either harness or accommodate some fundamental laws of nature, these case studies show that those executives who succeeded tended to manage by a very different set of rules than those that failed. There were, in fact, five fundamental principles of organizational nature that managers in the successful firms consistently recognized and harnessed. The firms that lost their battles with disruptive technologies chose to ignore or fight them. These principles are 1. Resource dependence. Customers effectively control the patterns of resource allocation in well-run companies. 2. Small markets don't solve the growth needs of large companies. 3. The ultimate uses or applications for disruptive technologies are unknowable in advance. Failure is an intrinsic step toward success. 4. Organizations have capabilities that exist independently of the capabilities of the people who work within them. Organizations' capabilities reside in their processes and their values, and the very processes and values that constitute their core capabilities within the current business model also define their disabilities when confronted with disruption. 5. Technology supply may not equal market demand. The attributes that make disruptive technologies unattractive in established markets often are the very ones that constitute their greatest value in emerging markets. How did the successful managers harness these principles to their advantage? 1. They embedded projects to develop and commercialize disruptive technologies within an organization whose customers needed them. When managers aligned a disruptive innovation with the right customers, customer demand increased the probability that the innovation would get the resources it needed. 2. They placed projects to develop disruptive technologies in organizations small enough to get excited about small opportunities and small wins. 3. They planned to fail early and inexpensively in the search for the market for a disruptive technology. They found that their markets generally coalesced through an iterative process of trial, learning, and trial again. 4. They utilized some of the resources of the mainstream organization to address the disruption, but they were careful not to leverage its processes and values. They created different ways of working within an organization whose values and cost structure were turned to the disruptive task at hand. 5. When commercializing disruptive technologies, they found or developed new markets that valued the attributes of the disruptive products, rather than search for a technological breakthrough, so that the disruptive product could compete as a sustaining technology in mainstream markets. Chapters 5 through 9 in Part 2 describe in more detail how managers can address and harness these four principles. Each chapter starts by examining how harnessing or ignoring these principles affected the fortunes of disk drive companies when disruptive technologies were emerging. Each chapter then branches into an industry with very different characteristics, to show how the same principles drove the success and failure of firms confronted with disruptive technologies there. The sum of these studies is that while disruptive technology can change the dynamics of industries with widely varying characteristics, the drivers of success or failure, when confronted by such technology, are consistent across industries. Chapter 10 shows how these principles can be used by illustrating how managers might apply them in a case study of a particularly vexing technology, the electric vehicle. Chapter 11 then reviews the principal findings of the book. Chapter 5. Give responsibility for disruptive technologies to organizations whose customers need them. Most executives would like to believe that they're in charge of their organizations, that they make the crucial decisions, and that when they decide that something should be done, everyone snaps to and executes. This chapter expands on the view already introduced, that in practice, it is a company's customers who effectively control what it can and cannot do. As we have seen in the disk drive industry, companies were willing to bet enormous amounts on technologically risky projects when it was clear that their customers needed the resulting products, but they were unable to muster the wherewithal to execute much simpler disruptive projects if existing profitable customers didn't need the products. This observation supports a somewhat controversial theory called resource dependence, propounded by a minority of management scholars, which posits that companies' freedom of action is limited to satisfying the needs of those entities outside the firm, customers and investors primarily, that give it the resources it needs to survive. Drawing heavily upon concepts from biological evolution, resource dependence theorists assert that organizations will survive and prosper only if their staffs and systems serve the needs of customers and investors by providing them with the products, services, and profit they require. Organizations that do not will ultimately die off, starved of the revenues they need to survive. Hence, through this survival of the fittest mechanism, those firms that rise to prominence in their industries generally will be those whose people and processes are most keenly tuned to giving their customers what they want. The controversy with this theory arises when its proponents conclude that managers are powerless to change the courses of their firms against the dictates of their customers. Even if a manager has a bold vision to take her or his company in a very different direction, the power of the customer-focused people and processes in any company well adapted to survival in its competitive environment will reject the manager's attempts to change direction. Therefore, because they provide the resources upon which the firm is dependent, it is the customers, rather than the managers, who really determine what a firm will do. It is forces outside the organization, rather than the managers within it, that dictate the company's course. Resource dependence theorists conclude that the real role of managers in companies whose people and systems are well adapted to survival is, therefore, only a symbolic one. For those of us who have managed companies, consulted for management, or taught future managers, this is a most disquieting thought. We are there to manage, to make a difference, to formulate and implement strategy, to accelerate growth and improve profits. Resource dependence violates our very reason for being. Nonetheless, the findings reported in this book provide rather stunning support for the theory of resource dependence, especially for the notion that the customer-focused resource allocation and decision-making processes of successful companies are far more powerful in directing investments than are executives' decisions. Clearly, customers wield enormous power in directing a firm's investments. What then should managers do when faced with a disruptive technology that the company's customers explicitly do not want? One option is to convince everyone in the firm that the company should pursue it anyway, that it has long-term strategic importance despite rejection by the customers who pay the bills and despite lower profitability than the upmarket alternatives. The other option would be to create an independent organization and embed it among the emerging customers that do need the technology. Which works best? Managers who choose the first option essentially are picking a fight with a powerful tendency of organization.